My castaway this week is an actress. If you followed Pride and Prejudice on BBC One, you'll know her as the inane and highly excitable Mrs. Bennet. If you're a true fan, you'll also know her from her performances as the monstrous Beverly in the BBC's production of Abigail's Party, or as the blousy northerner Mari Hoff in the National Theatre's The Rise and Fall of Little Voice. They're all roles which reveal her for what she is, a consummate professional of great versatility who's been entertaining audiences since she left Liverpool at 19 and went off to drama school. "It's my job to absorb and reproduce life," she says. "It all filters into me." She is Alison Steadman. Tell me, Alison, first of all, about Mrs. Bennet. She was very noisy and very demanding. Was she entirely your creation?
Well, I think I've got to give Jane Austen a bit of credit for the wonderful character that obviously was there on the page for me. But when I was sent the script, I could hear the voice. I could hear a voice. I could see the woman. And I thought, oh, I've just got to play this part.
But a lot of people criticised you for your interpretation of her, didn't they? I mean, they thought she was too noisy, too over the top. There was one wonderful phrase. Somebody said she was a Dickensian character, let loose among Jane Austen's best china. Did you have second thoughts when people started saying things like that?
No. I mean, it hurts a lot. I mean, I read a crit in The Observer a few weeks ago, and my son actually said to me, give me that paper before you start to cry, because I was terribly upset, because as an actor, you can't help but feel it's a personal criticism. Well, it is a personal criticism, and obviously it's very hurtful.
But it's a personal criticism of your interpretation. They're not saying you weren't any good, which really would be hurtful. They're just saying you interpreted it wrongly.
Yes, it's always quite frightening to play a role like Mrs. Bennet, because you know that, you know, there's ex-people have played it before, the Jane Austen Society, everyone's got their idea of how Mrs. Bennet should be. In fact, one woman said to me, you know, remember the eyes of the world will be upon you. As she pointed a finger at me, this is like we'd been filming for a week.
How thorough was the production? I mean, did you wear authentic clothes right down to the corsets?
Right down to the underwear. The lot, yes. You have to, because otherwise the dresses don't fall and they don't look the right shape. The detail was amazing. Down to the bread that we ate on the table was baked specially to the recipe of the period.
Really?
The food, everything.
I mean, why is that necessary?
Well, I think, in the end, if you're going to go for a production and say, you know, we're going to really do it well, you've got to give attention to detail. I mean, if you suddenly see a Pruitt's wholemeal loaf sitting on the table, everyone's going to say, oh, God, that's not right, you know, whatever. And actually, it's wonderful to sit there and, you know, suddenly this chef would appear with this wonderful turkey pie or whatever it was, and it was the real thing.
There was a lot of eating in it, wasn't there?
Bennets
were constantly at table.
Well, we were always saying, no wonder they all died at 45 or whatever, because the mounds of meat that they would, you know, it was mutton chops for breakfast, and that was just the start of the day. So it's extraordinary.
OK, let's get you to this island. Tell me about your music. How have you chosen them?
Some things I just like. It's as simple as that. And other things, you know, mean a lot to me. Music that my father used to play, and I love my father dearly, and it's nice to be reminded of him. Perhaps the odd romance in the past. And I think memory of teens and things.
Tell me about the first one.
Well, I love the 40s, and although I love Fred Astaire and the way he sings all those songs, to me, Peter Skellen and his arrangements are so brilliant, and I just love him.
When the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Peter Skellen and the way you look tonight is heartbreaking stuff, that.
It is. It makes me weep every time.
Now, Mrs. Bennet apart, of course, Beverly in Abigail's Party has to be your most famous role. Amazingly, it was 18 years ago she was first on the screen.
I know. She hasn't aged either, has she?
But she was, if you like, an early version of Essex Woman, really, wasn't she?
Yes. I mean, I based the character from a woman in Romford in Essex. So it's true, she was an Essex girl. But
how had you met this woman in Romford, Essex, then?
Well, when I say, I mean, working with Mike, you base your characters on a real person.
This is Mike Lee, your husband, the director.
That's right, yes. And really, that person is needed just as a jumping-off point. You know, an artist has to sort of put the first brushstroke on the canvas in the same way an actor beginning from scratch, improvising, has to have something to hold on to begin with. And it was a woman that I'd met when I was at drama school, and she sort of stuck in the back of my mind.
I'm sure she did, if she was anything like Beverly. I mean, loud, brassy, ghastly sort of nasal whine, endless sexual innuendo. I mean, she was a monster.
She was a monster, but she's a very sad case underneath it all. I mean, people kind of laugh at someone like Beverly, but to me, she's one of the most tragic figures I think I've ever played. Because when you take away all the tinsel and all the makeup and the false nails and all the rest of it, there's this really sort of empty shell with not much going on.
Trying to prove something,
desperately trying to be happy and enjoy herself and get some sort of fulfilment in her life. And
but you mentioned that the woman from Romford on whom you based her. Is that what you do all of the time? Are you consciously or is it subconsciously absorbing people you meet and spotting mannerisms and little facial tics?
I don't consciously kind of sit there and watch people and say, oh, you know, she's got a twitch in her right eye, I'll use that at some point. But I think if you're an actress, you've got to observe, because that's your job. You're reproducing life, and therefore you're being creative, and you've got to look all the time and listen.
But that's even more true and more necessary if you're going to improvise, which is what you do. I mean, it's not so necessary if you're always just speaking somebody else's words, a writer's words. I mean, tell me why that isn't terrifying for a director, your husband Mike Lee, to say, right, now we're going to do this play called Abigail's Party. You're Beverly. Go on. What's Beverly going to say next?
Well, it is terrifying. I don't think anyone would say it isn't terrifying, but at the same time, it's a very carefully worked out process, and the actors are very much under Mike's guidance.
I want to talk to you about that a bit more, but let's pause for another record. Tell me about number two.
Well, this one is Harlem Nocturne, Sam the Man Taylor. It's a record that I first heard when I was at drama school. When I first came to London, somebody threw a big party at a very posh flat in St John's Wood, and I was pretty impressed by all this, you know. I sort of was at this wonderful party, and the party went on till about 4 a.m, and I couldn't get back to my flat. So most of us stayed the night, you know, the way you do when you're that age. You kind of sleep in chairs and on the floor and all sorts. And I was kind of dozing in this chair, and somebody put this record on. And I just thought, gosh, this is just wonderful, and I've never forgotten it. And indeed, we used this track in Abigail's Party when Beverly decides she's going to try and seduce Tony. She wants to put a kind of smoochy, sexy record. She puts this on.
Sam the Man Taylor and Harlem Nocturne. It sounds as if you spent your childhood improvising, really, Alison Steadman. Your family were always saying, getting our Alison to do a turn, were they?
Yes, I mean, when I was born, my sisters were 10 and 12 years older than me. And I was a bit of a surprise, I think, a bit of a surprise arrival after the war, you know. And so I was really doted, and I was terribly spoilt when I was a child. And my sisters would dress me up and put makeup on me and parade me round. And I suppose I was always a bit of a clown. And it got that my mum now, she would say, there's nothing on television, turn it off, Alison will do us a turn.
But what did you do?
Well, I used to impersonate Hilda Baker and Beryl Reed. That's really embarrassing talking about this, but
but it was a fun household, was it? I mean, the family knew how to laugh, that's the point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the main thing that, you know, kept us all together was this great sense of humour. My mother and my father had a terrific sense of humour. And, yes, it was always fun.
And your grandmother was quite a turn as well, wasn't she?
She was. I suspect, had she been born in a different time, she probably would have been an actress. I mean, she was an actress, really, but she used to dress up and she used to do extraordinary things. And she was a sort of very anarchic woman and a kind of... My mother always talks about, you know, she'd come home from school and there wouldn't be this nice meal ready to put on the table. My grandmother would have knocked a wall down in the because she fancied a door in a different place, or she'd be out in the garden and she'd be sawing wood and she'd be making a chair or a stool or something, or she was a great gardener, she'd be redesigning the garden. I mean, she was a sort of wild, mad kind of woman.
Do you see yourself in her, then?
A bit, yes, a bit. I mean, I can sort of get totally absorbed in something in the garden or whatever, and the kids come home and, you know...
And you've knocked down a wall.
You've been shopping, you know.
So were you always the star of the school productions, then?
No, I wasn't, because at sort of junior school, I can remember, you know, being a comic and being in productions at school, but when I got to grammar school, it was quite an academic school and didn't really suit me terribly, although I enjoyed my time there, but there wasn't enough artistic stuff going on, really. But my great saviour was that when I was 14, Liverpool Youth Theatre started, which was great, because suddenly I could, you know, forget school, go to these classes, which were run by teachers in Liverpool, in a very open, free kind of way. You didn't have to audition, you didn't have to speak beautifully or whatever. They wanted kids with enthusiasm, and hopefully a bit of talent thrown in, but that didn't matter either, as long as you were there and you were enjoying yourself. And it was a terrific time for me, and opened all sorts of doors, and indeed, you know, led then to me going to drama school, and the kind of drama school I went to.
Record number 3.
Well, I've chosen John Lennon's Imagine. It was a difficult choice because I was a great Beatles fan when I was 16. I used to go to lunchtime sessions at the Cavern. I was kind of too young. My mum wouldn't let me go to town in the evening to the Cavern because she thought it was a terrible den where there were all sorts of awful things going on. And it wasn't. It was just, you know, it was terribly innocent and there was no booze. We used to have a cup of tomato soup and a bread roll and sit there and listen to the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers. It was wonderful, terribly exciting. But in the end, I decided not to have a Beatles one, but to have John Lennon, partly because this is one of my mother's favourite records. My mum is a terrific Beatles fan, and particularly John Lennon. And... I'll think of her, my island.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
John Lennon and Imagine. So, Alison Steadman, would you claim, like the rest of Liverpool, to have known there was something special about the Beatles at the time, or is it now the wisdom of hindsight?
All of us. I mean, if I went back now and we could get, you know, all that crowd that were in the Cavern. When the Beatles started, we used to sit there and, like, you know, 10 minutes they were tuning up, twanging, you know, guitars and checking amplifiers, and we'd all be sitting there, oh, when are they going to start? And then suddenly the four of them would sort of just burst into song, and you felt like you were lifted 10 feet in the air. It was a wonderful experience, just to feel the unity of this whole club just kind of bopping around.
So you were no great shakes at school. You left at 16, you went to secretarial college, but by the age of 19 you got to a drama school in Essex. Now, why that particular drama school? Why not RADA?
Well, youth theatre was very progressive. Again, you know, we didn't do auditions and, you know, we did very few productions, but we did a lot of exercises to get the imagination going, get your body moving and all those things. And when it came to choosing a drama school, I mean, I'd only ever heard of RADA. I think still most people have only heard of RADA. And I went along to the Liverpool Playhouse and talked to a lovely man who was then assistant director and an actor called Tony Colgate. And he said to me, look, he said, I think you should go to this drama school called East 15. It sounds like just your ticket. He said, come back next week. He said, there's an actor here who's been there and he'll tell you all about it. And he fired me with such enthusiasm. And of course, when I talked to this actor, he said, oh yes, all their work's based on Stanislavski and Laban movement. And and I thought, gosh, this sounds just right for me. Rather than, RADA still had quite a stuffy kind of feel to it for me at the time. It's not now, it's, you know, changed a lot. But then, 1966, it was still holding on to a lot of old sort of values.
But people were telling you you were good by this stage, were they? Although you hadn't done that many productions and you hadn't auditioned much.
I knew that I couldn't do anything else. I had to do it. It was a burning desire and had been from about 9 years old. And I thought, this is what I want to do and nobody will stop me.
So it all happened and you spent 3 years there, mm-hmm. and then 4 years in rep in the provinces. And then in 1972, a director called Mike Lee came to see you in a play back at home in Liverpool, this mm-hmm. was. Were you kind of booked both personally and professionally from then on?
Well, Mike was just about to do a play for Today, produced by Tony Garnett.
BBC,
yeah. And he was obviously casting it, looking out for people, came along to the theatre. I'd sort of known Mike briefly at drama school because he had directed at drama school, but not directed me, but only to sort of say hello to. And I remember thinking, oh, I like the idea of the way he works and the sound of what he's doing. And he sort of sent me a little note backstage and said, could we meet for a drink and have a chat? And he asked me to be in this film. And I was terribly excited because it was my first television. Oh, gosh, you know. Here I am, launched.
but which was more important at the time, the man or the part he was offering?
Oh, the part, definitely.
When did you spot the man behind the part?
Oh, I spotted the man when we were rehearsing. That was took a few weeks, but no, it was... I liked him, but there was no way it was... He was the same with me, I'm sure. It was just, you know, he wanted me in a film for my acting ability.
Oh, yeah.
So he told me.
Next piece of music.
This is a piece of music that... In fact, when I was at drama school, I had a little romance, the way you do. And in fact, the romance was a bit of a nightmare, and so was the chap. But he played this music to me. And although the memory of the romance isn't that sweet, I've never forgotten this music. And I just can imagine myself on my island being transported to the Auvergne with this music.
Aline Auger singing Bayero, one of the songs of the Auvergne, with the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Jan Pascal Tortelier. So by 1974, Alison, you were married. By 1976, you were improvising together, professionally, too. Nuts in May was the first, I think, of the improvised plays, wasn't it, when you played Candice Marie, this rather gormless vegetarian on a camping holiday.
Yes, that was a wonderful experience because we were down in Dorset, which was great, so we were actually rehearsing on location for 8 weeks. I think Nuts in May was shot in 16 days. I mean, it was very quick.
But let's get back to exactly how it's done. I mean, you don't actually rehearse on camera, to make it up as you go on camera. That would be very expensive.
No, I mean, it's shot as you would shoot an ordinary film, obviously, with a master shot and close-ups and cut-ins and all the rest of it. So you've got to be able to repeat it, absolutely. I think improvising on camera is a very dodgy thing to do, and it can look... You know, very amateurish if you're not very careful. But Mike's work is very much rehearsed and worked out with the actors before you ever get near a camera.
But nobody writes it down, ever. He just says, what you just did was terrific, we'll keep it in.
Well, it's a question of a long process. I mean, we improvise for hours and hours and hours, weeks and weeks, with only Mike watching and maybe a continuity person. Out of those improvisations, scenes will unfold under Mike's guidance, and he'll throw a lot of rubbish out because obviously a lot of it's terribly boring and it's really only a means to an end. It's just a way of developing the characters and developing the situations. But when we actually come to film, we might turn up on the set, on the location, 8 o'clock in the morning, and Mike will set up an improvisation, and out of that we'll then repeat it and repeat it, with Mike saying, well, leave that out, we don't want that, add this, talk about that. It's distilled and distilled until we get to the essence, as any writer would make a first draft and maybe a second one and a third one and keep throwing stuff out. Mike is doing that, but instead of doing it with a bit of paper and a pen at home, he's working on the floor with the actors.
So it takes a very special kind of actor to be able to do that. I'm sure there are some brilliant actors and actresses who would run a mile before they'd subject themselves to that kind of process.
It is quite a frightening process, and some people just don't want to let themselves be that sort of vulnerable.
Well, you have to be much more creative than the average actor, don't you?
You have to be creative, and you have to trust, really. And if you keep saying, well, why am I doing this? You're lost. You've just got to say, OK, I'll do it.
But it's one thing to do that kind of thing at drama school when that's what you're there for, and as you say, it doesn't matter if you never do a production. It's quite another to do it if you've got a commission and a budget and you've got people around you, you know, and you've got all the pressures of commercial theatre or commercial television.
20-odd years ago, it was completely new. People were a bit wary. Oh, what is this? You know, this modern method way of all this rubbish used to get talked. But now people are much more saying, oh, fine, OK. You know, and Mike has obviously spent years and years and years building up a reputation, saying to people, look, trust me, this is a new way of working, but it's mine and it will work if you just give me a completely blank sheet and let me get on with it. At the end of it, I'll give you something that's quite different. And I think he's proved that many, many times. And so now, backers are much more willing to say, OK, Mike Lee, here's X £1,000, you know, go and make a film.
Record number five.
This is Rodrigo. It's just a piece of music that I adore. It was a favourite of my father's, and I was very close to my dad. My dad died 4 years ago. And I have wonderful memories of just watching my dad listening to music, you know. He was a very loving kind of man and very passionate. And tears would kind of brim in his eyes when he would listen to something like this. And I suppose he taught me the love of music. And I just think it would be wonderful to have a bit of him with me on the island.
Part of Rodrigo's guitar concerto, played by John Williams with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Louis Frémeau. You don't seem, Alison Steadman, to have played many of the classic roles, you know, Hedda Gabler or Lady Macbeth or so on. Is that because you've turned them down or they haven't been offered?
I haven't been offered, mainly. I don't know why it is. I mean, in rep, obviously, I did. I mean, I played Ophelia and Desdemona. But, no, I haven't been offered those parts. I think because of Beverly and maybe Candice Marie and that sort of image, people think of me as playing more contemporary roles. But I've never yearned to play any part. You know, people often say to me, now, what part do you want to play? What, you know, what's really in your heart? What do you long to do? Well, I don't long to do anything until someone sends me a script. And then I think, oh, yes, great, I'd like to do that. But
like,
you know,
Mrs. Bennet.
Like Mrs. Bennet.
I mean, maybe she'll turn the tables for you in that sense.
Well, maybe. I think it was watched by a few people, so maybe I'll get some offers now. But no, I've never had this burning desire to play.
But you'll get all those offers, if I don't know how many productions are done at any one time, but there's sort of Restoration Comedy, Lorcs of Mercy kind of characters now, aren't you?
Well, I hope so. I mean, at least it would be nice to have the to make a choice, to, you know, to be able to choose.
Well, do you feel a bit sore about it? Your husband said such things on your behalf, hasn't he? He said that Beverly has been a kind of subtle albatross around your neck.
Well, I mean, it's, yes, I think all actors are remembered for one part. You are sort of saddled with it for your career. I mean, for the last 18 years, it's been terribly flattering for people to say, oh, Beverly, I've never forgotten it. Oh, I watch it, blah, 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 whatever. But sometimes I long for people to stop me in the street and say, oh, I saw you on television in another part and you were wonderful. But people, oh, I wait for it, you know, and they go, oh, Beverly, you know, but it, I mean, it's, say it's fine and one wouldn't wish it any different. But I'm still waiting to play the part that's going to push Beverly into the background.
Next record.
This is Pavarotti and it's an aria from Tosca. And again, this is a favourite of my father's. And I think this is just so passionate. I can never listen to it without crying. I hope I don't cry now. I may do. But it's just so wonderful. I've got to have this with me.
Luciano Pavarotti singing E Lucevan le Stelle from Puccini's Tosca with the National Philharmonic conducted by Nicola Rescigno. Your dad taught you to garden, Alison, so you can put that to good use on your island. What else do you imagine yourself doing to while away the days?
A bit of fishing. I've got to eat. And I'd probably gather a few sticks and try to make some sort of shelter, I suppose. I'm quite practical.
But what about the morale? Can you make yourself laugh?
No, I'm not very good on my own. I mean, I'd be all right for a bit, but I get very lonely very easily. I mean, I'm not someone that enjoys my own company particularly, and I don't think I'd really like being totally alone.
But obviously, you know, you're not frightened of your own voice, so you could impersonate, you could pretend to be your own company, I suppose.
Well, I could improvise a bit with myself, I suppose.
What will you miss most on your island? The family apart, obviously.
Moisturiser, I think, for my... I don't know, company, I think, is the main thing I'd miss.
What will you fear most?
Being bitten by a snake or something awful. I think being alone at night and, you know, being a bit chilly at night, I don't think I'd fancy that.
Record number 7.
And this is Billy Fury, Halfway to Paradise. I think it's just a wonderful record, but it does bring back a lot of memories of being an early teenager in Liverpool, sitting with my friend Roger, who lived 3 doors away, and we used to play records and drink coffee and think we were very grown up.
I want to be your lover, but your friend is the last day. So far away.
Billy Fury and Halfway to Paradise. I can imagine that life in the Lee Stedman household is pretty hellish. I mean, it must be bad in any director-actor household, but when one of you has a production coming up, what's it like when you're in the same one?
Well, we didn't work together for many years because our 2 boys were small and we couldn't both be out of the house, you know, for 18 hours a day, which is sometimes what it involves. You know, it is difficult. Obviously, with any profession, it's difficult when it's so demanding. The hours are long and going away from home. So it's not easy. But as long as one of us is around, I think, you know, keeping things ticking over.
But if you're working on the same production, it must be impossible not to take it home with you. I mean, it just takes over your whole life, which would be quite suffocating.
It doesn't. I mean, we've always had a rule that... any rehearsals always take place in a rehearsal room or on the set. I mean, it would be easy to say, oh, look, you know, can't be bothered going to that driving 5 miles to the rehearsal room, we just chat here, because a lot of it is talking initially. But we've always said, no, we mustn't do that, because that's the, kind of the thin end of the wedge, and it's unfair on other actors as well. It's always all right for them, you know, they're sort of sitting cosy at home. You've got to have the discipline of going to a rehearsal room. And also, when you get home at night, it's an unspoken rule, really, but we don't talk about the day's work and the film. That then goes on hold until the right time to talk about it, which is, you know, when we're actually rehearsing.
Very disciplined stuff.
Yeah, well, it's, you know.
What about when you're in a production, I mean, not with your husband, I mean, you've talked about the need to immerse yourself totally in a character. I mean, it again, it obviously uses you all up. You must be pretty difficult to live with, if not impossible, on those occasions.
I don't think so, because it's nice to be able to come home and throw that character away or put it on a low light.
You don't
worry
take it
about
out
it.
On the kids, then?
No, I mean, it's nice just to walk in the door and say, right, you know, the dog comes to greet you or whatever. Forget all that work.
So you've managed to balance the twin careers, really, of mother and actress quite well.
Well, I've actually enjoyed having kids and that taking me away from the pressure of having to turn up for read-throughs and filming and all the rest of it. I mean, especially when the boys were small, I always said to my agent, well, I'm doing this job, this is going to take me 3 months, and at the end of that 3 months, I want to have time at home. And he always understood that, so that I would have a period of time at home when I could enjoy being a mum for a bit, because it's a terrible thing to look back on your kids, you know, on their young lives and think, well, actually, I missed it, because when it's gone, it's gone. And I must say, I was lucky enough to have the luxury to be able to do that. I mean, a lot of actors listening now probably say, no, it's all right for her, you know, she was, and it's true, it's very, very difficult when you've got to earn a living and you've got to pay the mortgage or the rent or whatever, and you've got small children. It's a very difficult thing to juggle, but I was lucky enough to be able to take the time off in between jobs to be with them. It doesn't happen for a lot of people.
If somebody said to you now that you could never act again, that was it, how would you feel?
I'd be devastated, I think. It's so much part of my life that I couldn't imagine ever being without it.
Last record.
Last record is Ella Fitzgerald, Every Time We Say Goodbye. This is another one that makes me weep. I'll spend all my time on this island crying buckets. I take plenty of tissues with me, I think. Nobody sings this song better than she does. And years ago, I've got a great friend called Barbara. We were great mates. We grew up together in Liverpool. We went to school together. And we went through that thing that you do when you're teenagers of playing records and sitting crying, you know, whatever. And I just have a lot of happy memories of listening to Ella Fitzgerald in Barbara's back room, sometimes accompanied with boys, but mainly just to sort of really enjoy the music.
Every time we say goodbye, I die. Every time we say goodbye, I wonder why a little, why the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so.
Ella Fitzgerald and Every Time We Say Goodbye. Now, if you could only take one of those records.
Difficult choice, but I think it would have to be the Tosca. I think Pavarotti.
Well, that'll make you cry, but then so would they all. What about your book?
My book is 100 Years of Solitude by Marquez. I don't know if you pronounced that correctly, but it's the most wonderful book. It's the kind of book that I could just read and read and read and never get bored with, because it's so rich.
And your luxury.
Now, this is a bit embarrassing, this luxury. I would like with me that the flannels that you get in Chinese restaurant at the end of the meal, they heat them up and wrap them in those little sort of plastic covers, and they smell wonderful, fresh, lemony smell, and you can put them on your face and feel refreshed. And I would like a machine that provides those endlessly. But it must be the flannels, not a lot of restaurants now have reverted to using these sort of synthetic paper things, which are awful. It has to be the flannels. And I'd be quite happy on my island with my machine making me all these lovely flannels.
Alison Stedman, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your desert island dishes.
My pleasure, thank you.